Lecture 7, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Modern Science Fiction Film.
In discussing science fiction so far, I have made mention of the World's Fairs and so on, the screenwriting of Ray Bradbury, but mostly we have stuck with written texts, short stories, and novels. However, science fiction need not be thought of as existing only in written texts. In fact, given the prominence of film and television today, science fiction as written text doubtless reaches fewer people than science fiction in other forms. What I'd like to discuss now is the intimate link between science fiction and film. In fact, film has always been, since its inception, almost a variety of science fiction, because film has been the technological embodiment of universal ancient fantasies. Let me give you an example. I remember one time listening to the news. It was the night that Duke Ellington died. And John Chancellor, the newscaster, came on the television screen and said, "Edward Kennedy, Duke Ellington, died today. He'll play for us later in the show." How could he play for us later in the show? How can the dead live? Well, if you live in an electronic videotaped world, as a newscaster does, the tape of Duke Ellington playing for us is Duke Ellington playing for us. The filming of the dead and their preservation allows them to act now. Moving pictures are an ancient fantasy. Those Gothic novels had pictures on the walls in the Castle of Otranto or the Mysteries of Udolpho, where the eyes moved. The idea of moving pictures has always been a science fiction from the time they began. Louis and Auguste Lumière were among the first filmmakers, a couple of French brothers. Perhaps their most famous film is called in English The Arrival of a Train in the Station. They took this around in 1895 and showed it at country fairs. What was The Arrival of a Train in the Station? Well, there already were kinetoscopes, those things where you look through the spinning circular rim at pictures across on the inside of the rim, and as they spin, the slots in the rim change what you can see, and it makes things look like they move. If you take that and put it on film so that you can watch those images go in a continuous stream, you get modern motion pictures. The Lumière brothers took the idea of the kinetoscope, which always showed just repetitive actions, a horse jumping over hurdles, for example, and made something that could be much, much longer. They took their camera, they set it up by the side of a railroad track, and they let it take pictures as the train came into the station. Now, of course, picture this. The camera set up at about 3 or 4 feet above the ground, about the middle of the axle of the train wheel, the train coming in so that ultimately it's going to be only 1 foot to one side of the camera. The train appears in the distance. It grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. Now, why did they take that particular shot? Well, for one thing, they could do it outdoors. They didn't have the artificial lighting and the film stock necessary to do indoor studio work. They didn't have the ability to do things at night. They couldn't let actors move around one place or another. They needed fixed lighting conditions. They needed something, however, that would be alive, that would move. So they took a human being? A horse? No. A train. They took a piece of technology that was moving, and they captured it in a moving picture. They went around the countryside showing this great novelty, not the novelty of their particular film, The Arrival of a Train in a Station, but the novelty of film itself. They would go into some small town where the county fair was going on. They would set up a tent, and they would invite people in. The people would sit down, and on a sheet in the front of the tent, they would project this picture. the people would sit there and they would see the train start in the distance and get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and the people would run out of the tent in panic because they didn't know what a film was. This was magic. Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, is famous for having said, "A sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." The magic of the movies has always been technology. And every time the technology has advanced, almost immediately the most important use of the new technology has been seen in some science fiction or fantasy film. Perhaps the greatest early narrative filmmaker, that is a film that has a story rather than just showing us something in process the way the Lumiere brothers' films did, was another Frenchman, Georges Méliès. Méliès' most famous film is called in English A Trip to the Moon. And by his title, you can tell that he is pirating his countryman, Jules Verne. This 1902 film, however, is very, very far from Jules Verne, except in the spirit of playfulness and the passion for science. He takes a ballistic missile and shoots it at the moon, as Verne does. But in the very famous shot from this film, which I'm sure many of you have actually seen as a still, the man in the moon is represented by a big pie shape, and you can see the actual eyes of the man in the moon. Those eyes, looking through the pie shape, are the eyes of Georges Méliès himself. And there is a shot that shows this great big squatty rifle bullet, which is supposedly carrying Verne's heroes, going right into the eye of the man in the moon. It's a satire. One of the reasons that this short film, it's only about 4 minutes in total, one of the reasons that this short film did so well is that it begins by having the chorus line from the Folies Bergères kick their way up the gangplank onto the rocket ship before it takes off for the moon. So you get to see a lot of skin in this early movie. The science fiction is justifying a little bit of something you otherwise might not get to see. This is, in fact, a common trait of science fiction film. How many times have the bug-eyed monsters forced the girl to flee so that she just had to run so vigorously, shaking back and forth that her buttons just had to pop? Of course, there was no prurient interest in this whatsoever. It's just a mere consequence of having to flee from aliens. Just like Frankenstein, in the book, science fiction movies have always had a kind of implicit sexuality. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, one of Ray Bradbury's inventions, comes on shore and carries off our women, scantily clad in bathing suits. Now, the next great creator of science fiction film is hard to point to. The reason for that is that the next great creator of science fiction film is unknown to us. He's anonymous, or she. It's someone at the Edison Company, which began to capitalize on Thomas Edison's invention and produce independent films. In 1910, the Edison Company produced its first filming of Frankenstein. In fact, the actor who played Frankenstein in that movie was the son of a minister. And the father was so upset that this fellow played a godless creature, someone created unnaturally, that he was disowned by his father. Now, this particular film no longer exists in film form, but stills of it continue to exist, and some of you may have seen it, seen some of these. You often see someone swathed entirely in bandages with a strange, scowly look on his face, one arm held forward and lurching toward you. It looks like it's from The Mummy, but in fact it's from the Edison Company 1910 Frankenstein. The Germans and German Expressionism became very important in the between the war periods in the filming of science fiction. Fritz Lang filmed Metropolis from a screenplay of his own based on a novel by his wife, Thea von Harbo. Metropolis is a great, dark, lurid, Oedipal story about a man named Fredder, who is the son of a man named Frederson. As if it were not confusing enough to have the son have the name of the father and the father the name of the son, it turns out that the father is the ruler of a mechanized city, Metropolis. Metropolis, the word, comes from the Greek and means mother city. The spirit of this city among the workers is a girl named Maria. The workers are all terribly regimented. It's a typical 20th century dystopia. There are some great shots of the workers walking into the factory, shuffling along in identical drab gray uniforms. The factory itself opens like some strange, horrible temple, perhaps even a perverse version of womb return, and we see by its grinding machine as it consumes these lines of workers coming in that the temple is really another temple of Moloch, the god that eats its own children, like the Morlocks in the Time Machine. The father who controls the city, it turns out, married a woman who had been the fiance of a great wizard. And the great wizard is now enlisted by his ancient rival to make a robot which will be covered in flesh to look like Maria and go down among the workers and pervert them so as to prevent the revolution that's being fomented against them to break out of the tyranny of this mechanized city, run from the top of a Jacob's ladder, one of those conveyor belts that you jump on and go up a story and get off, run at the top of a Jacob's ladder by Fritter, whose office is dominated by a picture window in the shape of a functioning clock. Everything is clockwork. We are caught in this image. It reminds us of Charlie Chaplin's earlier film, Modern Times, with its great sequence of the character being caught, the worker caught in the cogs of the machine and being drawn through it in a serpentine fashion that makes it look almost as if he is film going through the threading process in a projector. Film, in other words, is the symbol of our enemy, the technology that rules us, as well as the technology that allows us to embody our fantasies. In Metropolis, the son, who realizes, because of the tutelage of Maria, the problems of his father's running of the city, the son falls in love with Maria and then is fooled by the robot creation, a second sibling created by the relationship between the father and the wizard. Finally, in fact, the city crumbles and everything is set free. It's a wonderful breaking down of the technological dystopia. But along the way, we see what it means to be caught in the teeth of the machine. This is science fiction film about science fiction film. This is science fiction film warning us about the future. Long, in fact, was always quite proud that he was able to give images to the world that stuck. For instance, in his 2 year later movie, 1929, Die Frau im Mond, the lady in the moon, the woman in the moon, in order to get to the moon in this, we have the German scientists sitting around and deciding when are they going to ignite the rocket. Well, just as early pilots used to call to the person on the ground who had his hand on the propeller, they'd say, 1, 2, 3, contact, so that the person who's about to pull the propeller would know when the electrical contact had been made. We had to have some verbal signal. The people in the rocket ship go 10, 9, 8, eventually 2, 1, blast off. Long always claimed, and he's probably correct, that he invented the idea of countdown in order to make more dramatic the scene in his science fiction movie. So science fiction, the real progress of science, and science fiction film have had this intimate effect. Metropolis and Die Frau im Mond are examples of German expressionism, a kind of strange, fevered artistic movement that covered all the arts in Germany in the Between the Wars period. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, 1922, is another famous work from this. The work of F.W. Murnau is very important. We see characters who are strangely askew. Their faces are not quite symmetrical. We see backdrops of houses that are kiltered on one angle or another. It's a dream landscape that's inhabited in German Expressionism, not only in the film, but also in dance, theater, and painting. This is the background for American Hollywood science fiction films that begin to become quite important in the 1930s. Perhaps the best year is 1931, when we have James Whale's Frankenstein. James Whale is the director. And also, of course, the famous Dracula by Bela Lugosi. But Dracula is not a science fiction film. Frankenstein, however, is. From the Hollywood point of view, however, Dracula and Frankenstein seem to be of a type. And there is merit in that. What is the difference between a science fiction horror film and a fantasy horror film? I think you can see the difference this way. One of the most riveting scenes in Dracula, and one which is repeated in virtually all of the sequels, is the one in which the title character comes up behind some unsuspecting young woman who is sitting at a makeup table brushing out her hair. The table has a three-way mirror, and the camera takes the point of view of the vampire, tracking as we go so that we can see the reflection of the room, the different parts of the room, as we change our angle on the back of the head of the woman brushing out her hair. Now, we are wondering, what will happen when the vampire lines up right behind the woman so that she will be able to see his reflection in the glass? Because our viewpoint is such that when that happens, we will be able to see him and him seeing her and her seeing him. We'll get all of this in one shot. But of course, what always amazingly happens is that when the camera moves to just that point where we know we're going to see ourselves, that is, we're going to see our vampire body because that's the viewpoint we share, there's nothing because vampires don't show up in mirrors. Now, the question is, why is it that vampires do not show up in mirrors? Why do we have this astonishing absence of effect in every movie? And the answer is, because vampires have no souls. To which I always think, isn't it amazing that we can see the chair in the mirror? In other words, horror stories of the monster sort, okay, of the monster stories, the horror stories, the Dracula-type stories, are anti-scientific. The rules in those monster stories depend upon mere collections of superstition. There is no attempt at plausibility. In fact, just as Bradbury tries to destroy plausibility to erect a fairy tale landscape by claiming that there are water-filled canals on Mars when he knows his audience knows that's not the case, stories like that of Dracula make themselves anti-scientific. They tell us they are to be read as psychological parables because, in fact, we know that the rules work only because we stipulate that they work. By contrast, in Frankenstein, the most riveting scene that we see and is repeated in every film is the corpse sewn together from different corpses, put on a table and hauled by chain up into the spire of the castle where the electricity from the sky can come down like Promethean fire from the gods and reanimate that corpse, bring it back down, and then we watch until finally we see the first finger move and then the hand and so on. In other words, the riveting visual effect in one kind of monster movie tells us we're looking at something which is against the world of science. In the other kind of monster movie, we're looking at something which tells us we live in a controlled, knowable world. In fact, both of these movies were very important coming in 1931, at the height of the Depression, because they both tell parables that fit with the political issues of the Depression. Dracula is a story of the old line lord, the old aristocrat who continues to prey on, drink the blood of, those who are more modern and democratic. Frankenstein is a story that is told in the movies in much the same way. Dr. Frankenstein, Baron Frankenstein, up there in the castle on the hill, finally is attacked by the townspeople swirling up to him with their torches on fire. There is no baron or doctor in the novel, as you know. In fact, it's an undergraduate gone berserk with his study of science. But in 1931, Hollywood saw in this science fiction parable a way of showing the relations in the class structures. If you think of that science fiction movie, we have the terrible, terrible pathos of Boris Karloff, inarticulate, looking at his creator, holding out his hands and making animal noises. In the novel, the creature is the most articulate character, in fact the smartest, a genuine Superman. What James Whale has done is taken this oversized, forceful creature and shown that he is intellectually and socially restrained by his creator. The monster in 1931 becomes an emblem for the masses, and the failure of the creator, Dr. Frankenstein, or Baron Frankenstein, depending upon which of the many sequels we're looking at, by failing to help his creature, educate him, create a bride for him, and so on, is showing the schism between the upper classes, the haves and the have-nots, in the Depression. It's a movie in which the vengeance of the monster is seen as appropriate, as opposed to the book, where the monster is a version of Victor, and it's a terrible tragedy that Victor's egotism has created this. In the movies, we can almost side with the monster because he is so radically mistreated. Igor, who exists in the movie, Frankenstein's assistant, does not exist at all in the book. Igor is another low-class character. The victimization of the monster by Igor, the turning of one worker against another worker in order to curry favor with the bosses, is an invention wholly for the sake of the movie. The whipping that Igor gives to the monster is really the proximal cause of the monster's antisociality and his desire to gain revenge. So we see then a class parable in the movies. However, in so doing, this science fiction takes good advantage of the possibilities of special effects. The lightning drawn from the sky in 1931 is a new effect in 1931. In fact, as film technology advances, science fiction advances. Almost all of the Special Effects Academy Awards, and in fact something like 90% of them since the end of World War II, have gone to science fiction or fantasy movies. George Pal, one of the great, from a financially successful point of view, producers of the 1950s, won one award after another for taking great old science fiction works like H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds and turning them into films. Now, in the 1950s, the same effects continued of seeing the science fiction film as the medium for popular political warning. Bradbury's It Came from Outer Space and The Beast from 20,000 Leagues we've already discussed as respectively the communist menace and the release of what goes wrong when our sexual urges and our atomic weapons come back to haunt us. There are some other notable films of the 50s, all B films, that is to say, they have low budgets. A films have high budgets. 1954, we have Them, with an exclamation point after it. This is the famous story of the six-foot ants, created by the testing done in the Nevada desert by America. Our own desire to develop nuclear weapons has caused this mutation. It's interesting that when our hero, played by James Arness, who will later go on to become Matt Dillon and rule over Gunsmoke, when our hero finally manages to get to the nest of the ants, which of course have enormous eggs since they're going to turn out to be six-foot ants, the nest is found in the sewer system, the flood sewers, of the city of Los Angeles. Now, by this time, 1954, Los Angeles is already the town associated with film. So what we have here is a little metaphor about Hollywood having created its own monsters. And these are the monsters from within. This is 1954, right after the McCarthy era has just ended, and when many, many, many Hollywood writers, producers, actors, and so on are still living lives that have been tattered by the political pressure. The fear of the communists underneath the city of Los Angeles, who will rise up and take us over, this is the McCarthy era hysteria. That we have created the possibility for these communists to exist by our own pursuit of nuclear weapons is what makes this such an interesting and complicated parable. Yes, it's a B-movie. Yes, it talks about our fears, but it shows them in a way that could not otherwise be shown. Science fiction film grabs onto the new technology, atomic war, and gives us an image we could not otherwise see. The first time you see in that movie a 6-foot-tall ant take its giant pincers and crush the wall of a mobile home, you realize exactly how much of an attack on the domestic bliss of America is being implied by the imagery here. There were other movies of that variety. Let's have some atomic weapons, blow things up, use cameras really close to an insect, and they'll look really ugly. Tarantula is perhaps the most famous. There is, however, another one which is more worthy of discussion, and that is The Fly, which was a cheapy movie, but it was made with a different premise. Here we're not worried so much about the enemy within. Here we're worried about science itself trying to create something new and having it go awry. The scientist creates a matter transporter, and he has an empty one, and he gets into one. And the idea is that he will be moved from one to the other. Unfortunately, without his realizing it, there is a fly in the one that should be empty, and the transportation is incomplete. So we wind up with a man with a huge head of a fly and a fly with a little tiny head of a man. Most of the movie is about the depredations of the fly, that is, the man with the big head of the fly going around and so on. But the end of the movie is really enormously poignant when we see the head of the man on a little fly caught in a spider web, and the remaining human characters who have fought off and killed this huge man with a fly head are now sitting on a bench outdoors in a garden, and near them is a spider web, which they don't see, but they hear a squeaky sound. And as the camera gets closer and closer and closer, the sound gets louder and louder and louder, and finally we hear, "Help me! Help me!" No one even hears the cry. He's caught in the web of nature. He is destroyed by having tried to do something unnatural. This brings us back to the roots of science fiction, that sense of community, science gone awry. There are some things that man is not meant to know. That movie gets remade in 1986 by David Cronenberg into what I think of as a truly significant film. In David Cronenberg's remake, also called The Fly, what we have is not a long middle part of the movie about the monster and his depredations. What we really have is a study of the relationship between the scientist as he gets transmuted bit by bit, as the genetic burden of the fly works its way through his body over time, and the woman who is coming to love him. What does it mean to not know what the person you love is capable of? What if you go to sleep next to someone today and tomorrow they wake up looking different? This is 1986. This is after the advent of AIDS. This is a movie that says you can meet somebody, you can think they're terrific, you can go to sleep and wake up in the morning and know that they are in fact monstrous, that they are themselves dying, and that if you stay with them, you will die too. However, it's a point that's well worth making and has always been the case. It's been the case ever since Oedipus discovered that the woman he thought was consolidating his reign of Thebes was, horrible to say, in fact, his mother. The Fly is a story which is susceptible to many uses. Science fiction film can give us that. There's another movie in the 50s that I want to pay a little attention to. In its original Japanese title, it is Gojira. And released 2 years later, 1956, in America, it is Godzilla. Now, Godzilla, like Frankenstein, is the first movie in an enormous series of movies. But Godzilla is worth our attention for a couple of reasons. One reason Godzilla is worth our attention is that it suggests a shift of science fiction to the West. Notice that so far we have been talking primarily about European and then American science fiction. With Godzilla and later the exportation of science fiction films in general, science fiction cartoons and science fiction television shows, we begin to see a movement of Japanese ascendancy, something I'll talk about at greater length in the next lecture. The other reason I think we want to see Godzilla as important is that it so perfectly captures that Oedipal paradigm which reminds us of The Tempest. Here we have a story of a Japanese scientist who has released something, which in this case is created by the mutation of atomic energy made by the American war effort. He's released something from the sea. He has a secretary. It's like having a daughter. There's no wife. And he cannot get back, he can't push back Godzilla. What do we need to get rid of Godzilla? We need to have a journeyman hero. The Ferdinand figure here is an American journalist. And what always happens in the original film and in all of its sequels is that the journeyman hero is in some sense smarter than the scientist, just as Ned Land, Jules Verne's Canadian harpooner, is smarter than Pierre Aronnax, his Verne's French professor. The journeyman journalist is able to say, well, I know, we'll just take a cattle prod and poke this thing and it'll go back into Tokyo Bay. And when it does go back into Tokyo Bay, the end shot that we see there is really symbolic. We've seen it in 100 films. There is the jack of all trades, the young man, with his arm around the shoulders of the woman, who is now rightfully his because he has protected the city against the terrible thing released by the brain work of the older man. The monster, whatever that is, to the extent that it is the demon, the intellectual genius of the doctor, is receding back under the waters, going back to death and dissolution, or perhaps being baptized to come back as something new. Who knows what it is? She says to him, is it dead? Is it over? And he says, we can only hope so. And then sometimes the credits roll up, beginning with the words, the end? Question mark. In other words, we have the boy getting the girl from the old man. Instead of Ferdinand moving the forest by hand, which is the task Prospero sets him, what we have here is the monster released by the old man, set to flight by the young man. This particular myth gets played out again and again and again. I think it is, in a way, a destructive myth. Why? By making sure that he who sends the monster to flight is always less educated than he who creates the monster. In effect, these grade B movies are pandering to the notion that common sense is all you need, that the life of the intellect, in fact, is a foolish one. In a sense, these movies undercut the popular passion for science that science fiction used to support, even at the same time that they support the notion of the sense of wonder that science releases. Just like pulp novels, pulp films are typically conservative, giving people a chance to indulge their stereotypes again and again and again, rather than challenging them. So these B-movies really give us the chance to see ourselves as smarter and more powerful than we really are. The last important movie from the 50s is Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Invasion of the Body Snatchers is the one in which the pod people come down, they sleep in our basements, and while we sleep, they form themselves into perfect replicas of us. And then when you wake up, by gosh, the person next to you only looks to be the same. In fact, they walk a little stiffly. We're back to "It Came from Outer Space." We have the enemy within. We have all the communist menace. This, too, was made over and, again, turned out to be an even better movie in its remake because, again, it concentrated not so much as the first one did on the politics of its moment, the communist menace, but more on the deep and universal psychological questions. What do I know about that person sleeping next to me? Now, all of this that we're talking about, from the Lumiere brothers and the county fairs to Méliès showing his little jokes with a rocket ship in his eye to the B films written by Bradbury and others, all of this is basically a film version of the pulp tradition. Just as the pulp literature became possible because of the technology of printing on pulp paper and the distribution system, this pulp film became possible because of B budgets. And so we should suspect that there is the possibility of there being an A budget film. Maybe it's not just playing games with the new technological tricks. Maybe we can make fine films that are science fiction as well. I tried to suggest that Fritz Lang's Metropolis is in fact a fine film, and that there's much merit in some of the B films, almost willy-nilly, like Whale's Frankenstein. But by the time we get to Stanley Kubrick, we suddenly find ourselves with a director who intends not to be a science fiction writer any more than H.G. Wells said, "I'm going to be a science fiction writer." Kubrick just said, "I'm going to be a director," and in fact has been honored as one of the greatest directors of all times. But if you realize that Kubrick has, in his own oeuvre, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Bomb, 1964, 2001, A Space Odyssey, 1968, and A Clockwork Orange, 1971, suddenly it becomes apparent that Kubrick may be the single most important science fiction director up until his time. Now, Dr. Strangelove was itself a funny Cold War satire. For me, the two most riveting images in that movie are, one, Peter Sellers, Dr. Strangelove, in fact, who is wheelchair-bound and has one mechanical arm because of accidents that have occurred to him, and finds that he has to keep holding his mechanical arm down with his good arm because his mechanical arm keeps wanting to give a Nazi salute. He is a man divided by the effects of his own science upon him. It's a wonderful image. And the other riveting image from that movie, too, is that of Slim Pickens on the bomb as it's going down out of the bay doors of the airplane at the end, about to blow up, and then we see that wonderful montage of mushroom clouds at the end while the romantic music plays in the background. Goodbye, everybody. How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. But the breakthrough movie for science fiction film was really 2001. For those of you who haven't seen it, I'll remind you that 2001 is really told in a series of radically connected parts. That is, they are not connected explicitly, they are just jammed together. The opening sequence shows early primates, in the course of which, this sequence, one primate band encounters another, and they begin to fight. One of the primates picks up a bone, looks at it, and does nothing with it. But another primate who has been affected by this enormous black monolith put on Earth by aliens for perhaps only a moment picks up a bone, hits it against the ground, and realizes that it has more power than his fist alone, and he uses it to kill. In fact, this notion of the evolution of humanity from the necessity of interspecies conflict and the development of weapons was the then current best anthropological theories. Robert Ardrey's African Genesis is the book that talks about this. In African Genesis, we see the fight. We see it enacted by Stanley Kubrick. Kubrick then has them walk away, the primates, after the first murder. According to Arthur C. Clarke, who collaborated on the screenplay with Kubrick for 2001, they were walking back from the back lot into the studio, and everybody packed up the gear, and the actors who were wearing the primate suits are shuffling along, and Kubrick was walking along idly, flipping the bone up and down in his hand, and suddenly he said, "Wait, And he made everybody go back. And he took the bone and he threw it in a rotation up into the air and had the cameraman take that shot. And that has become one of the most famous crosscuts in the history of film. That bone goes spinning up into the sky, and the next frame shows us the space station. What Kubrick has done is made a radical connection between the urge to kill and technology and our urge to explore and technology in a kind of visual metaphor stronger than anything that Arthur Clarke wrote. Kubrick began this project motivated in part by three short stories by Clarke: Transience, The Sentinel, and Expedition to Earth. Clarke co-wrote the screenplay with Kubrick, but the reality is that Kubrick's film, like Welles's novels, is richly ambiguous. We are never told what that monolith is. When another monolith is discovered on the moon, we're not told what that is. When, at the end, our main character gets sucked into a monolith, goes through some strange experience, and comes out at the end, this huge fetus hanging in an amniotic sac in mid-space over the Earth, we don't know what that is. But what we do know, from the early primates through the famous light show in the middle of the movie that leads to that ultimate outcome as the Star Child, called Star Child in the novel, what we do know is strange things affect us, and our minds do wondrous things, and the world is there for something. But what? The book, unfortunately, has no ambiguity. The book tells us explicitly, Star Child looked at the Earth and knew he would think of something to do. We don't know whether Star Child is even a Star Child and whether it cares about the Earth or not in Stanley Kubrick's film. In A Clockwork Orange, he took Anthony Burgess's novel from 1962 and gave us a future world in which people are conditioned radically in order to make them nice because the society that they live in is so bad, and how else cure a criminal? But then it's realized that this programming is so cruel that the main character, Alex, has to be reprogrammed to be cruel again, ultimately leaving us with this ambiguity. Since we are all programmed by our upbringing, what's the difference whether we're programmed intentionally or unintentionally? We can't avoid programming. We are all clockwork oranges. We are all both mechanical and organic. We're Peter Sellers with the one mechanical arm and the organic arm. We have within us a terrible conflict. That conflict within us, we have to learn to overcome. That is what Kubrick has been studying in movie after movie, not just these, but in his other movies as well. And when in 2001 we see Star Child as a fetus, we may be seeing for the first time the offspring of humanity not in conflict. Humanity at one with the stars, like Ray Bradbury's Americans who have become Martians at one with the landscape. This opened the way for science fiction film as high art. And the key work there is usually Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, 1982. A work based on a Philip K. Dick novel called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? A work in which the bad guys are androids we make. And we are so fearful of them, we have to kill them. We're back to RUR by Chapek. We have a movie with a high gloss in a post-industrial world, a post-industrial landscape of destroyed machinery, of people living in fear, of robots we can't control, of emotions we don't know how to live with. We have a new kind of film which uses the cross-cutting Kubrick made available to tell a story that's not conservative the way the B-movies did, but in fact is as up-to-the-minute as any kind of art that's produced at all. It takes the most available science fiction filming techniques and makes the most artistic science fiction film. Blade Runner is a monument along the way to the development of modern film. It is the first postmodern film. Just as Frankenstein showed us something new, Ridley Scott shows us something new. Science fiction film and science fiction have a shared history from the moment that science fiction film emerges. And in fact, that history is the one which now dominates the world's view of science fiction. We began in the books because that's where science fiction began. but it goes much beyond.
Lecture summary. Science fiction and film have been linked since the early days of motion picture making. Science fiction's visual nature lends itself to translation onto the screen. Film itself is also the embodiment of an ancient fantasy and is thus itself science fiction. From the early film Arrival of a Train in the Station by the Lumiere brothers to Ridley Scott's postmodern Blade Runner, film has had the power to panic, shock, and frighten people with a particular immediacy. Early filmmakers soon recognized that this immediacy meant that the strange and fanciful aspects of science fiction stories would make good movies. Between the two world wars, German expressionist films often used scientific and futuristic themes. Fritz Lang's Metropolis, for instance, is a dark tale of a technological dystopia that echoes Orwell's 1984. Like the science fiction works of H.G. Wells, many science fiction films attempt to highlight social and political issues through supernatural or technological themes. James Whale's 1931 film of Frankenstein used the monster to symbolize the victims of the Great Depression. Francois Truffaut's 1960s version of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 warned of the totalitarian menace. While many see so-called B-movies as silly and inconsequential, they have often dealt with broad and important themes. Stanley Kubrick was one director who recognized that these themes might be made into better movies. His Dr. Strangelove satirized Cold War anxiety, and 2001, A Space Odyssey, is still considered a definitive science fiction film. Based on stories by Arthur C. Clarke, this movie begins the exploration between our mechanical and organic selves that Kubrick continues in movies like A Clockwork Orange and Scott furthers in Blade Runner.